Hello, Brooklyn, how you doing? G, where you going? We cannot come to. And if I can, I'm gonna be your man. You can be my lady and have my baby and drive my car. You got me crazy. So crazy. However you going, baby, where you going? Just take me, cause I'm so taken. If you take it, I'm just saying, baby. Hello, Nets fans. How you doing? This is the Russell and Fro podcast, a podcast for Nets nerds by two Nets nerds. I am Brett, the man bun Garofalo, sitting co-pilot to my captain, O-Captain, Carl the Talent Jackson. We've got a really fun episode tonight involving a special guest and a healthy back and forth on the second best team in New York. But first, we need to give the fans what they want. Carl, can you please tell everyone how life has been for you.
Brett, life is good. I am very excited to welcome our guest. I guess the one bad thing in my life is I do have kind of a sizable gash in my head that I got on the playground today, running up the stairs to the slide, which was not made for a gentleman of my stature, either height or width. But it is, you know, I'm excited to welcome a fellow father onto the podcast, the former host of the Gotham podcast, which I'm sure several of our listeners listened to previously. It was an 8-episode miniseries. Is that right? Fellow father, host of the Gotham podcast, lifelong Knicks fan, guy who lives and dies with the New York Knickerbockers, watches every single game. Otherwise, he's on the Ets bandwagon with you, Brett, the Mets, the Jets.
And the Brats.
And most importantly, the point guard for the Koskob triumvirate, Mr. Vivek Devaraj. Vivek, thank you so much for joining us, man.
Glad to be here. You guys have an awesome podcast. I love listening in, even though it's not my team. You guys, you know, it's basketball at its purest, and yeah, it's a joy to be here.
It's definitely basketball at its nerdiest, and certainly most long-winded. So hey, listen, we've been noticing a little bit of tension. We've been noticing a little bit of animosity between our two fan bases. And, you know, we thought, listen, we might as well just let's get together. Let's kumbaya. Let's, you know, if this devolves into, you know, verbal fisticuffs, that's okay. And if we could find common ground and you know, learn to love each other, that's great too. You know, we're always trying to pump positive vibes out there like the cologne that they pump out of the Barclays Center as you walk in to give you that Disney magic. So, I guess like Brett, where do we want to start? Do we want to start with, you know, apparently from what I've heard, the Knicks are good.
I was doing some internet research and it looks like they are good, which is crazy to think about because all we've talked about this year is the Nets. There's been so much Nets content out there, but I have to start with Tom Thibodeau because I think based on his Minnesota Timberwolves tenure and all of the data that was in the ether about him and what had happened to his former players, there was probably some trepidation from Knicks fans when he was announced as the new coach coming into the season, especially with a young team. And it has proven to be quite the opposite this season. So I think I just wanted to get your take and have you walk us through the emotions of first initially hearing that Tom Thibodeau was going to be the new coach of the New York Knicks to now where they were on the verge of a 10-game winning streak last night before Chris Paul shot a ball about 3 miles into the air and it went through the hoop.
Yeah, for sure. So if you guys recall, we've had a rotating cast of just utter mediocrity at the head coaching position. You know, our most recent three have been, I think, Derek Fisher, Jeff Hornacek, David Fizdale. It's just slop. So when Thibs was announced as the head coach, obviously I think we were talking a little bit about, you know, the Nets former coach could even, you know, Mike Miller get the job. Like there were some pretty good contenders in there. Thibs, I think, brought instant credibility. If people were not going to move, it was short-sighted. Just, you know, looking at his career arc, he was part of those 90s Knicks. You know, he was foundational to what the Celtics were able to do in the aughts. Coach of the year with the Bulls, I think top three coach in the coach of the year voting subsequent to that coach of the year title. He's brought the Timberwolves to the playoffs and maybe had a falling out. I think part of it is people thinking that he's a defense only guy. And, you know, you see the Warriors win with their offense style. You see sort of, you know, three pointers take over the league. And I think people just kind of question, is he the right guy for this era of basketball? And I think he's proven the doubters, you know, wrong. The Knicks don't necessarily have great three-point shooters, but, you know, they can 3-and-D, space the floor. They're doing stuff with basically the same exact roster they had last year, and it's all Thibs. It's unbelievable what he's been able to do to this team. I think what goes under the radar is his player development ability. And there, I think a quote from Derrick Rose, like, I think he said that Thibs loves him unconditionally. It's not what Rose can do for him. He just, like, literally just, like, loves him. And, you know, that kind of bond, that kind of culture that a head coach is able to create, I think it's just, it's unlike anything Knicks fans have seen since Riley and Van Gundy, to be honest.
You left out one of the most important Tom Thibodeau facts, the fact that he went to high school in our home state of Connecticut, hard-hitting New Britain, Tom Thibodeau.
That's true. I think he grew up a Knicks fan. I think it's not that big a secret. He's basically a Knicks fan, and this is his dream job. And so I'm just, you know, it took him until he's 63 years old, but I'm glad he finally got it.
Man, it's been a long road for him too, looking at that string of assistant coaching jobs that he had for years and years and years, getting fired twice and still making it to the Mecca.
Yeah.
A true rags to riches story. I couldn't help but think about the way he's perceived in the league when you were talking through that. Cause I think there's been so much focus on the negative aspects of Thibs, especially going to the player empowerment era, and so much more data and analytics focus going on the health of players in the league and how many minutes his former players played. Folks tended not to look at the other side of that, which was just the sheer amount of effort and grit that his players played with when they were underneath him. And I love that line, Tom Thibodeau loves me unconditionally. If you believe that about your coach, you're probably going to be willing to play 40 minutes a game and run every offensive set like your life depends on it and go hard on every defensive rotation. And yes, those things might not be healthy in the long term, but also look at how many other coaches get that type of effort and production out of players from veterans all the way down to rookies. It's not many. And in fact, during the regular season, a lot of these coaches, teams will punt the regular season, so to speak. And Thibs guys don't do that. And I think to get that type of effort out of players in this era of basketball is almost more impressive than getting that type of effort out of the Bulls when he made that run from 2010 to 2015.
Yeah, this is a feeling that I've had, and Bill Simmons was talking about the other day. So it made me sort of really double down on it, but the players just love playing for him. You see it, like, you know, some guy goes on an 8-point scoring binge and everyone on the bench is just unbelievably jazzed for him. Like, it's this team, this is like a true team, and I've just never seen anything like it. And a lot of that is just the culture. You know, give some credit to Leon Rose and broader management, but this is just a total culture change, and it's been all Thibs.
Oh man, and we saw it in Brooklyn too. And Carl, maybe that's what you were going to say, but everything started with a culture change and dovetailed from there. Now, who knows what the future of the Knicks holds? Of course, right? You can, like, get super excited about a season like this, and then nothing comes of it, and we feared that would be the same way for us in Brooklyn, and we got super lucky. But it does feel like this should at least be a turning point for the Knicks.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, look, in a lot of ways, the Knicks are kind of where the Nets were, you know, 2017, 2018. Mm-hmm. I can make an argument that you guys didn't have a Randall, like this version of Randall, on any of those teams, but very similar space where a ton of guys who are all, like, playing for each other, you know, no one's really expecting a ton of them, and they're overperforming. So a lot of parallels for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, I actually looked at just comparing this year's Knicks to the 18-19 Nets, which is obviously, like, you know, in the time that Brett and I have been doing this, our favorite team. It's the team that we're still named after, despite the fact that the two players that are in our name are no longer, you know, with the franchise. So the Knicks, I think, are a little bit better, both in terms of record and in terms of metrics. Like, the Nets that year were they were actually, they had a 109.6 offensive rating and a 109.7 defensive rating. So they had like a negative 0.1 net, like about as even as you could be. The Knicks are like a plus two right now. And the record, I didn't get into like extrapolating it out, but it's a little bit better. And obviously they're in the four seed right now. Whereas the Knicks or the Nets, sorry, got sixth that season. So I think it's like, it's a bigger sort of come up in the sense that, because I feel like they both came from relatively out of nowhere. They were both sort of expected to be, you know, pretty low on the heap. And like you said, Vivek, like a lot of the same idea in terms of reclamation projects, cast-offs from other franchises, guys that, you know, were sort of thought to be, you know, over the hill or not necessarily the player that they were drafted to be. So it's really fun. And, you know, we just had so much fun with that season on the Brooklyn side that like it's in a lot of ways, I think it's just really happy, you know, for you guys to be going through it because, especially because I think just for basketball in New York in general, both teams are better off if both teams are good, I think, you know. Yeah.
There's a sense of pride when either it's a team of people you've drafted or a team of people that you've sort of fixed. You've brought them under your umbrella. So in the Knicks case, right, obviously we've got, you know, Mitch Robinson, we've got Quickley, Barrett, and they're all sort of growing under Tibbs. You've got Randall, who has essentially been a cast-out. This is his third team, and he's been good elsewhere, but, you know, he's taken this game to another level. He's basically putting up what Barkley MVP numbers. It's a different era, but it's incredible stuff. You've got Nerlens Noel, who's really just been a guy in the NBA, and I can make an argument he's been just as good defensively as a guy like Rudy Gobert. He has been unbelievable. You could put together a highlight reel of Nerlens Noel blocks of dunks at the rim, and it would get you fired up to run through a wall. It's just been unbelievable. You know, guys like Alec Burks and Bullock, like, look, they've just been kind of guys, and they know their role on this team, and it's been a lot of fun.
You guys, Knicks fans have been waiting for a good team for so long that we're getting Nerlens Noel to Rudy Gobert comparisons less than 15 minutes into this podcast. This is exactly where we wanted this to go. I couldn't be more excited to be here.
And I love Nerlens, and he was definitely on my sort of short list when I was looking for, you know, on the cheap guy, like when we were talking in the offseason about like, okay, if the Nets were to trade Jared Allen, you know, who's like kind of an on the cheap guy that would have a huge impact, and Nerlens was definitely one of my favorites. So I have a lot of love for him, and I'm glad that he's flourished in the role that he has been in, because I do also think that the Knicks are probably a better opportunity for him specifically than the Nets would have been just given the styles of play and things like that. Yeah. But I do think I made a little bit of a face at the Rudy Gobert thing, which made Brett laugh. A lot of guys are like almost Rudy Gobert, or like 65, you know, or like 75% of Rudy Gobert. It's like taking that extra step. I feel like that's.
I mean, he can't catch the ball, and there's a reason why he's the backup. But for the role that he's playing, he's been great.
Yeah.
Plus, we all know where he went to school and why he's on the Knicks as well. So there's, you know, there's that little tie-in. So I wanted to
who his agency is.
Yeah, right. Who his agency is. He went to hard-hitting New Britain, of course. I wanted to talk through the things that I've heard about the Knicks and their playoff chances and just get your take on some of those things. And I think a lot of it ties in with our former Tom Thibodeau discussion about how his teams play and perform in the regular season and how that can be extrapolated throughout the playoffs. So I'm just going to talk through a few things and you can respond and agree to anything that you want to. But I think I view the Knicks playoff risks as three areas. The first one would be the incredible effort that we've been talking about gets negated once you get into the playoffs. And you can break it down into two areas. When like the Knicks, they play really hard on both offense and defense. And we talk about defense, but they also run their sets really hard too. And when they set screens, they really set screens. And that's made a difference with a lot of these players. But they have great prep for these games as well. And when you get into the playoffs, those two things, play hard, great prep, that can be used to describe any team, even the teams in the play-in. So there could be an argument to say, well, those two advantages might go away once you get into the playoffs. And I can pause there if you want me to, or I can keep walking through this.
No, I think that's totally fair. The Knicks play every game right now like it's a game 7 elimination. And in the playoffs, everyone's going to do that. I think even even with that being the case, I think the Knicks have been playing at a very high level against good teams for a long time. That's not just this 9-game win streak. If you recall, their two losses prior to the win streak, 2 points to you guys, 2 points to the Celtics. So I think they're going to be able to hang with anybody. I mean, maybe not, you know, the Nets specifically, but they're going to be able to give anyone a run for their money. And even in those games, you guys remember, I think, I don't know if it was that loss or the previous Nets game, like Tibbs did some crazy thing where he was double teaming the inbounds pass and literally game planning for a jump ball for the Knicks to get the ball back. And like we clawed back into a game where it should have been over with less than a minute left. So I trust Tibbs. There's a reason why, you know, his teams have done really well. And hopefully the minutes don't catch up to Randall. That's a fair point.
There was one game that I had to turn off because, or I didn't turn it off. I muted because I think it was Mike Breen and Doris Burke were doing the game, who are fantastic announcers and objective, and I love them. And they were just gushing so much over the Knicks' trapping defense, which was totally textbook and well executed and working. And the Nets are just such a Keystone Cops when it comes to inbounding, just completely tripping, like stepping on rakes all the time. I just couldn't handle it. So, I think just like little things like that, you know, like Brett said, like, I think he and I actually both listened to, the Game Theory podcast with Sam Vecenie on The Athletic, and he had, Nikias Duncan on, and they were talking, but basically like, cause he watches a lot of college stuff and scouts the draft and was like, catch me up on everything that's happening in the NBA. And so they did a big segment on the Knicks and Nikias's whole kind of thing was just, you know, they are, and you know, credit to Tibbs and credit to the players, like, you know, part of what they're doing right now is just hammering the margins like wherever they can and just really like squeezing as much juice out of the orange as they possibly can. And so, you know, I think it's really fun to watch a team do that and overachieve. And you know, there can be some concerns going into the playoffs in terms of like how much that sustains, you know, particularly when you look at Randall shooting, you know, the percentages that he's shooting from three, although he's also like, I mean, I think the leap that he has taken is legitimate. And I think the sort of body type and, you know, place that he's coming from as an offensive initiator is not necessarily something that teams are used to stopping. So, you know, I think there's reason for optimism, certainly, particularly depending on, you know, what the draw is in the East.
I'll say this. I'm glad you brought up Randall's minutes as well. I'm just going to read through a couple stats that I looked up from this season just because it was fun to look at this. So let's start with games played. The only team with more than one player in the NBA's top 10 of most games played is the New York Knicks. And they have RJ Barrett at 62. So he's actually been the leader in games played for the Knicks, and then Julius Randle at 61. The highest in the league is Zubac on the Clippers, believe it or not, at 63 games. So that was interesting. Then if you switch over to minutes played, the top three in minutes played for the 2020-2021 season for the entire NBA are Julius Randle, Nikola Jokic, and RJ Barrett. And the only other team with two or more players to play over 2,000 total minutes for the season is Sacramento. So not necessarily the best company to be in there. And then one more stat here, because this is fascinating to look up. Minutes per game, Randall is still number one, but interestingly enough, Barrett drops down to 20th, and now you've got two other teams with more than one player in the top 20 of minutes per game with Toronto and Washington. So very interesting. I don't know how that affects this season, but might affect things moving forward. I don't know if there's anything you've noticed there.
Yeah, look, that, we can make fun of Tibbs for some of his minute allocation and stuff like that. Like, honestly, he's doing a really good job tempering Rose's minutes. Like, Rose has been really good, but bring him off the bench because he wants to keep him fresh for the long haul. So, you know, he's going to run RJ Barrett to the ground because he's 20 years old and like one of the youngest players in the NBA. Like, let him run. And Randall like transformed his body during the offseason. He like just threw up a million three-pointers, like took conditioning seriously. So I think Tibbs has a pretty good pulse of who can handle what. And look, once in a while, I'll get pissed when Randall's still in the game. We're up 20 with 2 minutes left. Like, why is Randall in the game? But but by and large, I think Tibbs knows where his players' bodies are at.
I think that's fair. Quite frankly, I really think the only thing that you could negatively associate with that could be sometimes minutes allocation is representative in extra gear in the playoffs, where it's not necessarily the players are playing harder. It's that your best players, your best lineups are playing more. And in this particular instance, I don't know if you would say the next two best players are RJ Barrett and Julius Randle, but they're two key players. There's not too many more minutes that you can give them in the playoffs. So are there other areas where they can fill in around those margins, or is there really no further gear there?
Yeah. So I think one thing that's helped is actually RJ Barrett has kind of taken over the lead guy when Randle has gone to the bench. You'll see that oftentimes in the first, 4 minutes of the fourth quarter, Randle will sit and RJ will take over the game. Now, if that can become a thing where multiple times a game they can do that, they can stagger the minutes, I think, you know, they could find a nice solution where they're not stretching the minutes, you know, to the max. The other thing that's sort of helpful, and I don't know how many teams have this, but people like Rose and Alec Burks can sort of be the lead guy, you know, coming off the bench. And maybe depending on matchup, they can find the right, you know, who's hot and who's got a good matchup they can exploit. Ideally, they don't just keep leaning on Randle to the extent they've done so far. And in a playoff, when you play in a team, you know, four times in a row, they're gonna find some solves, and you have to find counter solves. And I hope the Knicks have enough firepower to figure that out. But look, we're not going to know the minutes thing until we get there, and I have a strong feeling that both Barrett and Randle are going to be playing more than 40 minutes a night come playoff time.
And, you know, oddly enough, only two players are still in the league from that original 2010 Tibbs team. If we're going to talk about, you know, minutes destroying people's careers, it's 10 years later, but they're both on the Knicks, which is great. Taj Gibson and Derrick Rose. I love that set.
Did Joakim Noah officially retire, or is he still technically
we're still paying available? Him, right?
You're still paying him. We're still paying Darren Williams. It's just incredible symmetry here.
The Nets are not paying Darren Williams, but the Mets are paying Bobby Bonilla. But I think that I mean Brett and I watched Joakim Noah beat the Nets in a playoff series without any legs in 2013. So I feel like he could probably do that.
Dude, I mean, look, this speaks to the whole Tibbs thing. Taj Gibson, anybody could have signed Taj Gibson. He was just sitting at home. Tibbs brings him on. He's the backup center, and he is playing out of his mind. He's playing as good as he's ever played, and I'm shocked. I'm shocked how good Taj has been.
He's a Brooklyn guy too. He was somebody that I thought the Nets might be in the mix for just because of where he's from. But obviously, you know, the Knicks would have been his hometown team growing up. So, and we'll get into that later. Sorry.
Oh yes, we will. Well, so the last thing I wanted to point out was the Knicks half court offense, which hasn't been great. Luckily, the defense has been really good and really stingy and forcing turnovers and forcing steals. So you all have been able to get out and transition and really make the most of that. I think the Knicks are 23rd in overall half court offensive rating. And coupled with that, I think y'all are 28th in overall half court offensive possessions per game as well. And the argument could be made that in the playoffs, you're going to be playing better opponents that won't turn the ball over as much. So that could flip the script a little bit. Have you noticed anything about half court versus transition and how they might be able to take advantage of that?
Yeah, so I think the half court game really struggles. And this is, you guys have heard me complain about this, but with Peyton in the starting lineup, you've got Peyton and you've got Noel, and you've got Barrett, who will hit an open catch and shoot three, but he's not going to sort of create a three off the dribble. So you've got sort of two and a half guys who are sort of clogging, and I think it just makes it really hard to get into offensive sets. If you look, there's a small sample size of games where Peyton was out, and they had to start either Rose or Quickly. And I would guess, I haven't looked at it myself, that the half-court efficiency in those games was probably substantially higher. Look, a lot of times they're maybe overly deferential to Randle, you know, and I bet the games where Randle has really, you know, done a good job of kicking out, he's averaging more than six assists a game. So, look, I think as long as they've got the spacing around them, the half-court will be okay. Obviously, Noel to Mitch is, you know, would be an upgrade. You know, Mitch is actually going to catch the ball, lob finishes. Look, there were rumors of him being like shooting, like all offseason, there are all these like Instagram videos of him shooting threes and then never happened in any game. It's like the it's like the Ben Simmons, like, you know, mystery, or is he's ever going to shoot the ball. So look, I think maybe the secret weapon going into the playoffs is they'll just finally not play Elfrid Payton, and you'll see some efficiency numbers go up. But totally valid call out. Like a lot of their offense is generated just from unbelievable defense, deflections, blocked shots, and you know they're going to have to figure out both ends of you know, offense from the half court set if they're going to be successful in the playoffs.
Well, and you know, maybe it'll be the best thing for the Knicks moving forward too, because sometimes when coaches' backs are up against the wall, that's when they'll finally change their stripes on things. And you know, maybe if the Knicks get down 3-1, 2-0, he'll finally come to his senses and start quickly or play him a significant amount of minutes. And then all of a sudden it's like, well, you know, we did in a playoff series, it worked, Peyton has to defer, and then all of a sudden, you know, we just roll into next season and we're good to go.
Look, honestly, part of it I think is just Tibbs like wanting guys like quickly to earn his stripes, right, and not feel entitled. And I'm sure there's some method to the madness. I'm not going to get overly critical, because you know, like, you even in that Suns game last night, like quickly like kind of kept them in it for a stretch there. It's been fun to watch,
man, some of the shots he and takes. What do we go ahead, sorry.
Yeah,
I was just saying, what are we nicknaming him these days? Is it still Big Quick Energy?
I love Big Quick Energy. I haven't
Big
seen
Quick Energy is a phenomenal nickname. That's the one I was hoping to pull up.
If you need a quick fix, go to the Quickly Mart. I mean, there's a lot of directions we could take this.
Yeah, for sure.
Piggly Quickly.
Yeah, I mean, look, part of the reason why I'm a little annoyed Quickly's not starting is that I put down like $50 on him to win Rookie of the Year, and man, if he were starting,
yeah,
and that ball injury happened, oh my god! I obviously Anthony Edwards is really good, but man, he'd be in the mix.
The Knicks success story and a little bit of the NY media market juice, I think, would have helped him.
Yeah. Absolutely.
So, Brett, I guess do we have more stuff on this topic, or do we want to move into sort of? Brett and I are, I don't know if we're good cop, bad copping you here, but I think he's hitting the analytical side of the brain. I'm hitting the emotional side of the brain a little bit on this. Are you good with your stuff?
I think the only other thing, Brett, that we could touch upon a little bit more would be RJ Barrett's development, especially looking at his rookie season and how so many people were on RJ Barrett Island and we're suddenly off RJ Barrett Island after not even a full season too. It's like, oh wow, they really missed on this pick. This is looking terrible. This is Kevin Knox 2.0, blah, 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 blah. And then all of a sudden he comes back this season. He looks like a completely different player. And I think one of the quotes I heard was, he's not the type of player that we thought he was going to be, but he's on pace to still be a great player. And I love the turnaround in less than a season there, but wanted to get your take as somebody that's way closer to it than we are.
Yeah, RJ's maturation has just been absolutely phenomenal. I think he benefits from Randall taking a leadership role. I think he benefits from Tibbs' presence. But, you know, he's completely transformed his shot. I think I listened to a couple of interviews from his shot coach, and basically they were saying how, like, I think Fizdale and some of Fizdale's assistants tried to get him to, like, get his elbow to be straight instead of bent out. And it was just kind of messing with him. So they got him back to being bent out. I think they found some good examples of left-handed shooters where the bent out actually is fine. And so, you know, him being a lefty, there being some quirks to his game, you know, he's figured out. Right now, his spot up three is unbelievable, especially spot up three in the corner. And basically a shot coach is saying that, like, look, next year they'll work on pull-up threes and they'll work on some of the other things. You got to walk before you can crawl. You got to crawl before you can walk. And so he's figuring that stuff out. His toughness is just unmatched. He'll bounce off two guys, maintain his balance, finish the and one. It's just crazy. He's got this herky jerky style, just an immense, just like mental fortitude. And he's got a decent mid range game too. So I'm struggling to find a good comp for him. He's already a very good defender, and I think sky's the limit. I think the lack of obvious comp is part of the reason why people are like, oh, is he a bust or not? I think he's just going to be his own guy. In a perfect world, you know, maybe he can be some different version of a Kawhi, just like no one ever thought Kawhi is who he is now. And I think hopefully RJ can kind of carve his own path to be some version of that. Book's still not written on him, and I'm glad he's sort of getting his revenge tour on everyone who wrote him off last year.
I
was just gonna say, like, following that same kind of development path of Kawhi, where I feel like Kawhi could come in and make an impact on the Spurs, on a team that was competing, and just kind of like layer the skills in sort of one by one until he built up his offensive game to being, you know, the superstar that he was. I didn't see the same videos that you're talking about, but I listened to a podcast where they talked about those videos, and I thought that was, you know, just in terms of breaking the skills down and sort of saying like, here's the focus areas for this year, and, you know, focusing on one thing and adding that one thing to your game and becoming proficient at that one thing. And then next year we'll focus on something else, as opposed to, you know, trying to develop a breadth of skills all the way across the board. And I feel like it's, to me, I mean, this is something that I thought a lot when Kenny Atkinson was the coach of the Nets, because I thought he was so good at that type of development. And I think instilling the system where the team knew what they were and what they wanted to be the entire time, even though the earlier seasons of the Nets before that 18-19 season were much, much worse than this Knicks team was. I mean, they were terrible, but they at least understood how they wanted to play and what they needed from guys. And I think that really helped the development of guys like Caris LeVert and Joe Harris and Spencer Dinwiddie, because it wasn't just roll the balls out and fuck around and hopefully we get a high draft pick and maybe you get good in the process. It was really, I think, more targeted. So, you know, I think that bodes really well for RJ. And sorry, Brett, I cut you off there.
No, I'm just excited that we finally have a team built around two lefties. When has that ever happened?
Yeah, I think Simmons was saying it the other day. We're like, mainly Randall, but RJ does it too. Like they shoot with their left hand sort of falling out of bounds, and like no one has ever done that before. And it's just, it's only a thing a lefty can do, and it's just like kind of like messes with your mind when you see what they're doing. So I'll take any little micro edge. Yeah, we gotta get
that. That would be the ultimate small ball lineup. That would be awesome. Imagine that. Barrett at the three, Randall at the four, Thad Young at the five. Let's go.
Just lefty hooks all day, everything from the left side. So actually that sort of sets me up to transition perfectly, because RJ Barrett is also a really fun Knicks Nets kind of connection, because Steve Nash is his godfather. And I think, you know, in listening to some of Steve Nash's press conferences this year, you know, when they talked about those games, I mean, he sounds like somebody that grew up in this kid's life, like, and is just super proud of him. So I think that's really cool. And that's a really cool kind of crossover and point of commonality, you know, between these two teams. And I think, you know, I'll kind of get into it in terms of what we want to talk about in this sort of segment, but, there is, I think, a little bit of a difference between sort of the players and the, you know, systems and sort of what they represent right now, and then sort of the fan perception. And you can look at it kind of from a basketball perspective. You can look at it kind of from a storytelling, branding, marketing kind of perspective. So, so let me tee this up for you. So for those people listening, you know, Brett is a lifelong Nets fan from the New Jersey days. Vivek is obviously a lifelong Knicks fan from, you know, I mean, I guess I've only been in one place, but, and I am kind of the interloper who, you know, pledged my loyalties to the Nets when they moved to Brooklyn in 2013. I was kind of an NBA nomad before that. So I feel like that gives me a slightly different perspective here. And so I'm going to kind of moderate this. I'm going to ask you guys about your feelings, mostly so that I can kind of share mine up front. So I found it a comment on Twitter that I think really encapsulates sort of my opinion on the fan rivalry that we've seen this year. So obviously, like, just to set the stage, you know, we've seen you know, the enthusiasm pouring out of Madison Square Garden, which has been so cool. A lot of that has then boiled over into like fuck Brooklyn or fuck the Nets chants, which were not led by Masai Ujiri this time, which is, you know, last time a fuck Brooklyn chant was. So, you know, there's obviously a little bit of animosity and it's a little bit weird. And, you know, it's an interesting history because here's, you know, the Knicks that have sort of owned the city and the Nets that kind of moved in. And famously, Mikhail Prokhorov said, we want to convert Knicks fans to Nets fans. So the tweet that I found was from Anthony Puccio, who Vivek, I think you're familiar with, but is a, you know, Nets writer from Nets Daily, or formerly from Nets Daily. He now writes for the Association NBA newsletter, which everybody should subscribe to. And it was like a reply. He said, I do think there's a funny dynamic behind Knicks Nets. Both are inferior to one another in different ways. And I thought that was like really just hit the nail on the head, because from a Nets perspective, and Brett, you can correct me if I'm wrong after I talk for a second here. The Nets are like, I feel like always a little bit the little brother team, right? Both because you had the New Jersey, New York City kind of little brother aspect going on. And then I think now even in the city, like they're pretty clearly the second team in New York. I think we'd be kidding ourselves if we said, I mean, not in terms of on the court, but I think in terms of what people in the city get excited about. Like, I think it's fair to say that they're the second team. They're not, you know, that's why Bob from Nets Daily is like so concerned about getting the back page headlines. You know, so I think that's fair to admit in a safe space here between all of us. I think partially that's a generational thing, you know, because if you think about it, like to do a very 35-year-old white man thing and use myself as the example for everybody, you know, we were all, and Vivek, I know you're like 16 years younger than us somehow, even though we're in the same grade. But we were in kindergarten in 1992 when the Knicks took the Bulls to 7 games in the second round. And that, I think, was Riley's first season. That was sort of the start of the 90s Knicks era. So anybody, and I think kindergarten is sort of where I would draw my line as like my first real sports memories. I may have some before that, but not really. So like, if you think about it from that perspective, if somebody that's 30 right now, like doesn't really remember the 94 Knicks Rockets finals, doesn't really remember any of those early Knicks Bulls Jordan series. Like they'll remember the Allen Houston finals, but not necessarily like the early days of that Knicks dynasty. Anybody that's 25 doesn't remember even the Allen Houston era at all. So I do feel like the sort of the Knicks grasp on the city is somewhat, you know, tenuous from that perspective. And I feel like in terms of the Knicks inferiority complex, like I think you have kind of the sand slipping through the fingers thing going on. You already have player like somebody like Kyrie talking about how the, you know, 02 and 03 Nets teams were more resonant with him. And granted, he's a Jersey guy, so it's a little bit different. But, you know, I think younger players don't necessarily have the same fondness for the NBA in the 90s that we do, because, you know, we're older than everybody in the league at this point, more or less. And I think that like so that's part of what's difficult. You know, particularly, and then I think also on top of that, you have just the phenomenon of player empowerment and player movement means that I think the historical cachet of a franchise means less than it ever has before. Because like, if you think of it from attracting free agents, guys aren't thinking like, I'm going to be associated with this franchise for the rest of my life. They're thinking, you know, where am I going for the next 5 years? I feel like the team that's gotten hurt by this the most is the Celtics. And there's some other stuff going on there, but I feel like that equalizes the playing field. And the teams that have obviously benefited the most are the Clippers and the Nets, because, you know, if you want to play in the New York market or you want to play in the LA market, like now you have two options each instead. And so I feel like, and I tweeted this a little bit earlier, Vivek, so I want your sort of honest thoughts and reactions on it. Like, it has to hurt quite a bit as a Knicks fan to have been sort of spoon-fed this idea since LeBron was in Cleveland in his first go round that sort of the salvation for your franchise is going to come from big name free agents in their prime wanting to play in New York, and they're going to come to Madison Square Garden because it's the mecca of basketball. And, you know, you guys have more or less failed to land that person for so many years, only to watch like the Nets charge into New York, try to take things over, sort of fail, like kind of detonate on the launch pad a little bit with the with that first like Darren Williams, Joe Johnson, Garnett, Pierce sort of try at it, literally go through NBA hell in terms of having no draft picks for 5 years, come out the other side and like succeed at the thing that you guys have failed at for so many years. I mean, like that has to hurt a little bit, and that has to be part of what is charging the reaction now. Is that, am I guess I'll start with you. Am I fair to say that? And then I'll let Brett respond to the stuff I talked about at the beginning too.
Yeah, look, I think most of what you're saying is pretty fair, right? A lot of people have scrutinized ownership, some sort of foolhardy, you know, managers like a Phil and predecessors to him. You can't blame a star for not coming to New York if they just don't want to be in the Dolan ecosystem. And that's why you have the sell the team chance. You've got people just constantly railing on Dolan. He's really just an aloof owner. But the one thing I'll push back on, and this might just be me, I might not be representative of Knicks fans. I've always been I really want to build through the draft. I want to build my guys, and I hope my guys become the team, right? Like, so the examples of this sort of historically, the Spurs are kind of that, right? It was Pop's guys, and they became, you know, juggernauts over you know, multiple decades. More recently, the Warriors, like those were all draft picks. Durant joined one of the, you know, joined there, but like those are all Warriors draft picks. That was a Warriors team, and in my heart of hearts, like that's how I would want to build a contender, right? Like I bet if I gave you two alternate scenarios, one where the 2018 Nets, every player on that team was 25% better, and they got their version of a Julius Randle, and they became a title team, like you would probably take that over what's happening right now, right?
Somebody asked that on Twitter earlier this year, and I said exactly that. I said, yeah, I 100% would. It 100% feels better if it's your guys. 100% would I rather be rooting for a world in which, you know, this, you know, Caris LeVert and Spencer Dinwiddie and Joe Harris and, you know, bring in star X, you know, to level those guys up. And you know, Caris LeVert is the superstar instead of Kyrie. Yes, I would definitely take that. I do think that would feel better. There's nothing like watching somebody grow, and I would include Jared Allen in that as well. Watching somebody grow like that, you know, I think the trade-off is sort of the certainty of the quality of the product, you know, and not devoting 8 years to watching that grow and then finding out like, I didn't quite get there.
Right. I mean, and then to your point about like, you know, who owns the city, like, you know, Kawhi and Paul George made a hell of a splash going to the Clippers. It's just never going to be a Clipper town, right? If you opened up the WFAN phone lines and 20 callers talk about basketball, 19 of those 20 calls are going to be about the Knicks, no matter how good the Nets are, right? Like,
but do you think that will be true? So I agree with you that that's probably true right now. Do you think that that's true 15, 20 years from now?
Yeah, no. You guys are probably closer to it, right? So obviously the 25-year-old, you know, doesn't really appreciate, you know, the Allen Houston Knicks. But the 25-year-old is probably more glued, like just following players. Their NBA, their top shot account, and they're following LeBron from Miami to Cleveland to LA. I don't know, like, how much new fandom amongst, I guess, what Gen Zers are happening in Brooklyn. I don't know. Maybe Brett has some insights, or you guys have some insights just from what you guys, you know, follow day to day. You're literally going to have to build a fan base of an entire new generation. I don't know how many Andrew Yangs there are out there to literally switch from Knicks to Nets.
And then kind of switch back.
Some more votes, you know, that's really how it goes. What Burrow am I in today? I'm a Knicks fan.
I do think that's fair. I mean, I do think that that's fair. Of a really good point about like the 25-year-olds following players more than following teams. I mean, I think that's certainly, and I think that goes along with kind of the cachet of the franchise thing that I was talking about. Like I think that's the biggest generational divide that I notice. And I think when, you know, people talk about like what's, you know, NBA TV ratings or small markets or things like that. Like, I feel like that's like one thing that people miss a lot. So I do think that that's really important. I think that the Nets are probably, so the other thing that I wanted to say is, as the one of us that's lived in the city, the Nets are certainly, I think, you know, a lot of lifelong Knicks fans would sort of look at them as kind of like the carpetbagger interloper who just sort of like, you know, showed up in the city but didn't grow up there kind of person. And I would personally argue that the city, that person, that character archetype has made up New York City for its entire post-colonial history. And like, you know, you'll always hear, you could take a time machine back through the entire history of New York, you know, from Dutch colonization, and you will hear people talking about that exact thing. And I think that's one of the things that's always been so cool about New York is it's so, the fabric of the city is so layered in with people who are, have been there for generations and people who have been there for 15 minutes and feel like it's their city and will be their city forever. So, you know, I think that's an interesting point as well. The other thing that I think is also funny is, I was getting real into Google Mapsing. It is 4.8 miles, I think, as the crow flies, between Madison Square Garden and Barclays Center. It is 5.6 miles from Madison Square Garden to the Izod Center in the Meadowlands. So really not a far move. The two closest NBA arena, like the next closest NBA arena or two arenas to each other are Sacramento and this is when the Warriors still played at Oracle. And that's like 65. So, you know, very, very close, but obviously I think coming into the borough, like, you know, changes the game, changes the dynamic quite a bit.
I have so many thoughts on this. You guys have covered both of them, but I'm gonna dig in a little bit deeper. I think about it this way, Carl. I do agree with your point that the Nets are certainly playing for the future, but there's a lot of context that goes behind why they're doing that and why that makes a little bit more sense, because it almost seems like a cop-out, right? Hey, we're accepting that we're not the big team. We're playing for the future. Who cares if we're not the big fish in the big pond this year? You sent me that great article from The Athletic, and I forget who wrote it, so you can refresh my memory, that was talking about the history of the Nets fandom. Do you remember that one where they were saying, if you asked the Nets franchise or a Nets fan to define the archetypal Brooklyn fan, they couldn't really do it. And when they went around and they talked to Nets fans about how they got into it, everybody seemed to have a little bit of a different story. Well, you know, I lived close to the arena and the tickets were cheap, so I decided to go there. I was born into a family of Nets fans, or, you know, we just didn't really like the Knicks franchise. It wasn't really just this like, hey, we grew up in New York. We were all about the Knicks. It's a Knicks town. I just became a Knicks fan, and that's the gospel for me. So now that the Nets are in Brooklyn, part of that move was, of course, a cash grab, but also to define and have a home base of Nets fans that they could play off of. And I actually don't think that the Nets are looking to convert Knicks fans into Nets fans. If we do that, awesome. I think that's wonderful, but I think that is the exception rather than the norm. I don't think that's what we're playing for. We're looking to create those Kyrie Irvings and I, who grew up in 20 years, are like, oh my God, that was so nostalgic. I always think back on those Nets teams with rose-colored glasses. I remember watching those games with my dad. Man, I have this old jersey. I have this hat that's twice faded because I've wore it on floating on the river and drinking White Claws, whatever it is. I think that you can make a parallel to political fundraising where, okay, so we'll go back to Andrew Yang, right? So he's running on the left. If he's looking to fundraise, he's going to look at people that have donated to the left before or folks that were likely to donate to the left but maybe haven't done that. He's not going to go to conservatives and try to convert them into people that are going to donate to a left candidate. And that's the same thing with Knicks fans. The Nets aren't going to go and be like, hey, Knicks fan, root for the Nets. That's probably not going to happen. So that's why I think the smart play is to play for that long term and hopefully create some of that nostalgia. And
for sure. Like right now, like all of my peers, anyone who's a Knicks fan who's my age, we think fondly of the 90s Knicks. That is like that memory. It's like, oh man, the Knicks suck right now, but man, those 90s Knicks, those are so good. Maybe let's get back to the glory days. And hopefully for your guys' sake, this current iteration of the Nets, there's a 3 to 5 year stretch or whatever, where there's that is the memory they're harking back to. And to your point, it's a long-term investment. And hopefully this can be sort of the foundation of how those new fans came to be and like reinforces their fandom.
And I think that's really what we're playing for and what we're hoping for. I just, the if you want to say like there's a Knicks-Nets rivalry right now, like, yeah, I think that you could say that. I think you could probably boil it down to the things that Carl and I have noticed on Twitter. It's Nets fans belittling any Knicks positivity that's out there. That there's that meme that's got the championship banner, and then you've got the banner next to it, and it's like, didn't turn the ball over in the last meme, 2 minutes of the game. You know, just like that's
didn't get bumped to MSG2 is my favorite line I've ever seen.
Like that is an incredible meme, right? But that's like, that's really as far as the Nets fans are taking it right now, outside of just complaining about random Knicks Twitter comments. And then you've got the Knicks fans in turn belittling any Nets news, saying, hey, listen, it doesn't matter because the Nets don't own New York, are never going to own New York, and the fan bases just don't compare. And that's really what you can boil it down to. There's not much beyond that outside of the occasional, hey, like Brooklyn sucks or the Knicks sucks chance at these games, but we haven't even seen what these full crowds are going to do once arenas start blowing up. Now, I will say the last point that I'll make is, even if the fans didn't want a rivalry, that doesn't matter because a Knicks-Nets rivalry is incredibly good for the league. It's going to make the league money, and I would say the players have never been more connected to investing in the league doing well, having great ratings, creating content that people want to consume as well. So the players are also going to play it up. You've got Kevin Durant saying, oh man, I would love a first round Knicks Nets series. Give that to me all day long. Letting comments between him and Michael Rapaport go live and commenting on it on Twitter. And I think all you have to do to show how invested the players are in rivalries like this, creating content and getting fans interested, is look at how much griping there was about the shortened off season, even from guys like LeBron James. But then when the players realized how much money there was to lose by not fitting all of those games in, they shut up pretty quick and then decided to have the shortened offseason and play 72 games. So like, they're all invested. They want to play this thing up.
Yeah. Well, I was going to say, I think we've been trying to hint at this a couple times. Is this a real rivalry? You know, and in my opinion, you don't have a rivalry unless both teams are good. And they just have not been, at least in my, for my lifetime, majority of my lifetime, they just have not been good at the same time. And you can make an argument the Kid Marbury stuff was sort of a rivalry, but this is the first time where we're going to potentially have, you know, both of them being top four seeds, legit, you know, playoff teams. And I think this is what we're witnessing right now is the birth of a rivalry. I think it's been a quote unquote rivalry by geographical convenience. But I think we're about to embark on a true rooted in basketball rivalry. And I'm excited for it.
Yeah.
And I think that's the best thing. I mean, it's not only the best thing for the league. I think it's the best thing for both teams as well. Like, I think there's, I mean, to your point, Brett, you know, just in terms of like political fundraising or just marketing in general, like I think, you know, like I said, there's no shortage of people that are, you know, new to the city that aren't necessarily from that area in the first place. And, you know, I think getting, you know, whipping the city into a basketball frenzy, getting people excited about basketball in general, and then, you know, having the Knicks and Nets both be good so that they're forced to take a side, kind of like what you saw in the 50s with like the Dodgers and the Yankees, or the Dodgers, the Giants and the Yankees. Like, I think that is nothing if not good. That is how you grow the fan base, right? Like, you grow the fan base because people get excited about basketball because that's what people in the city are talking about. And, you know, that brings them to games and that makes it exciting. So, you know, where if you had asked me, honestly, Vivek, in 2018-19, like, I would have told you that the way that I thought it was going to play out was that the Knicks were going to sign Kevin Durant and Kyrie Irving, and the Nets were going to be this scrappy team that got, like, Jimmy Butler, I think, is like always sort of the archetypical fit, you know, from my perspective, because like, you know, just a grinder, and, you know, they were going to be the underdog, and, you know, clearly they flipped positions. But I guess to close it out, like what are your thoughts on the Nets this year? Like, what are your thoughts on sort of the way that they've assembled? Like, have you watched them at all aside from the Knicks games? Like, what do you think there? Just as a fan of basketball.
Yeah, I've caught them a handful of times. Obviously, I've mainly watched them when they played the Knicks. But look, hats off to what they've built, not just with the big three, but like with Harris and, you know, these random guys like fitting, like playing perfect complementary roles. It's a good team. It's a good team. They'd be my pick if I had to bet my life on it right now. Like, I still have a preference for like this best case scenario of the of you know IQ becoming Manu Ginobili and you know Barrett becoming Kawhi and that being like our you know path to a title. But look, that's you know a hope and a wish, and what you guys have done in Brooklyn is you know built a legit contender. You've made some you know huge moves. You've parted with people who have been core to like what Brooklyn fans were coming to love, and you know these are business decisions, and it's putting you one step closer to a title. So look, it's a beautiful brand of basketball. You know when everyone's on their game, it's just unbelievable. When Kyrie, James, and Kevin are all clicking, we've only seen it a handful of times, to be honest, but it's magical. So look, if the Knicks were to bow out, you know I'm not a huge Harden fan. I'm going to want to see him get a ring. I like Durant despite you know some of the controversies he steps into. So I don't know. Am I a bad member of this rivalry if I root for Brooklyn? I don't know.
I don't think so. I'm going to run a hot take by you that I have that I've told to Brett a million times, and realizing that the beer that I've been drinking was higher alcohol than I thought. But I'll phrase it as a trivia question, and it's more about the inner workings of my weird mind. There is a team, there is an NBA champion from our lifetimes, from our, let's say, I'll even narrow it down to our time in high school, that I have compared this Nets team to, even though they seem to be polar diametric opposites of each other. Could you guess which team that is?
The Pistons?
The 2004 Detroit Pistons. Just in the sense that
I don't see it at all. Tell me more.
Let me break it down for you. Complete opposite, right? In the sense that the Pistons were a defensive minded team, but the Pistons were a team that won the championship despite you know having one of the worst offenses of any team that has won. So in terms of like you know most NBA champions are sort of top 10 offense and defense. They are certainly an outlier where the offense lagged way way behind that. And they won because their defense was so ridiculously elite. That I think the flip of that is sort of what I think the Nets are gunning for as part of the playoffs here. And then the other thing that I think would be an interesting thing is that 04 Pistons team in a lot of ways kind of broke the league, right? Like they changed the hand-checking rules after that because people thought that like that brand of basketball was too ugly and they wanted to kind of open up offense. I wonder a little bit if this Nets team, if they were to win, would represent a pendulum swing kind of all the way in the other direction where, you know, has freedom of movement gone too far? Are we opening things up for offense too much where, you know, we have to step in and, you know, curtail that. So I think just from that sort of perspective, it's a total bullshit contrarian kind of argument. But I wonder if like, just from that perspective, like, I feel like those similarities are there. Plus there's the Rasheed Wallace trade and the James Harden trade midseason. So that's like another piece of it. And we had mapped Memon Okur to somebody, but I don't remember where it landed.
That's truly incredible.
We'll say Blake Griffin for now.
Oh, and then, hey, while we're here, just one last thing I wanted to bring up, if you don't mind, Brett, just I'm totally off the rails. I did want to compare that. So agree with everything that we've talked about in the on-court rivalry. In addition to that, the area that I think the Knicks and the Nets are undisputedly 1 and 2 in the league, and it's just a question of who's 1 and who's 2, is in the broadcast booth for both teams. Mike Breen and Walt Frazier as the, you know, A team for Knicks broadcasts. Fantastic, venerated, wonderful. The Ian Eagle, Sarah Kustak, and Richard Jefferson triumvirate. And I know RJ doesn't do every game, I think that belongs right up there with them. I don't know if you've listened to them at all or have any thoughts on that, Vivek or Brett, either of you.
So I'll be honest. I haven't listened a ton. I love Ian Eagle from his days, just like doing random radio on WFN. And, you know, whenever he's calling, whether it's basketball or football, he's a joy to listen to. You'll have to give me the reviews on RJ. Cause I don't think I've actually listened in when he's done the games. from a Knicks perspective, we're spoiled. We're spoiled with Breen. His backup is Kenny Albert, and Kenny Albert, in and of himself, you know, he is also a very good TV announcer. Yeah. The one thing you guys not
as
might
is
not
Ryan
be aware of,
Rucco.
Yeah, yeah. One thing you guys might not be aware of, it sounds like they haven't have to said it officially. It sounds like this could be Walt's last year in the booth, and I'm getting really misty over that. Yeah, Breen and Walt keep hinting at like it's his last year and blah 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 blah. They haven't actually said it. So if you get a chance to listen to a Knicks broadcast this year, you know, soak it in, because I'm not sure how much longer we're gonna have Walt in the booth.
Did you buy your daughter Walt Frazier's children's book about like building vocabulary?
Well, I'm about to put it on my Amazon cart now. You mentioned it. I didn't know he had one.
You know what, though?
Reading about it in like Sports Illustrated. Sorry, go ahead.
You know, it's okay. If Walt's going to go out this season, I think that Marv Albert has already laid the blueprint on how not to go out. So this is probably like, hey, listen, you want to go out before people are saying, hey, Marv, maybe, you know, maybe it's time. Like maybe, and then 5 years later, you're like, Marv, it's time. Get out of here. Leave gracefully and have people say, no, Walt, don't go. Come back to us.
No. I love Walt. I was telling you guys in the text thread, I did a basketball camp in like elementary school at Dundee, actually. And Walt Frazier came, and I remember getting his autograph on like a slip of paper that I like then preserved in contact paper. And I'm sure it hasn't been thrown out, because my parents don't throw things out. So I'm sure they're like, when they show up at my house sometime, it'll be in a bag of otherwise trash. But no, he's fantastic. The one thing I will say about the yes booth for the Nets is I think they kind of almost invert the relationship from a comedy perspective, because Ian is like always rolling with dad jokes, and Kusak is like the straight straight man, but I guess it would be straight woman in this scenario. And then when RJ's in the booth, he's just comes absolutely out of nowhere with like Ian's like kind of dad jokes and you know references and stuff like that, and RJ's just like ridiculous comedy, like when he
Bill Walton,
honestly, kind of like Bill Walton.
He's more intentional than Bill Walton. Bill Walton he's a flower child. He says whatever the heck he wants. Richard Jefferson's sole goal is shock value and trying to break Ian Eagle, because yes. Ian Eagle is the consummate professional. He will throw things out there that are slightly off color just to see how Ian will respond. And he's never broken, to Ian's credit. He is always
incredible.
It's so much fun to listen to.
Like when Ian referred to Richard as the color commentator, and he said, actually, I prefer to be called an African-American commentator, like that, that's like a perfect example, but also provides spot on analysis. And then Ian's doing things like, you know, dropping like for Bruce Brown, he had like 30 Bruce Springsteen references every time Bruce Brown touched the ball the other day against the Raptors. So it's, I don't know. It's pretty special. It's been special.
That's awesome. I got to tune into some Yes broadcasts. This sounds intriguing.
It was the only thing you really should. So, the tough years.
Yeah, and that's always why they rank way higher in Zach Lowe's league pass rankings, because they're the minutia category. Like he loved their court, and then the broadcast booth always boosted him up, which it absolutely should have.
Yeah, you guys got to get Zach Lowe on this podcast.
No, it should be. We all went to Greenwich High School.
Through his dad. We got his dad for trigonometry. So his dad, the pinnacle, arguably the pinnacle of my athletic career, if not for some of our wins over Coscom, was I played water polo for 1 year for his dad when I was 10 years old at like the beach club. And I was named most improved player of the year. Because like I could
use that in your cold intro to Zach to get him.
I'm gonna bring him in. I'm gonna tell him. It's a cool try. Like got like an engraved plate. It's a cool trophy.
Your dad made me most improved player, and now I'd like you to make us the most improved podcast. It's that simple. That's all we need to tell him.
I won't be drunk by the end of the next one. I promise. I'm not drunk. I'm business buzzed, but
business buzzed.
That's incredible.
It's a double. sponsored by Frost Beer Works. Says it's 8%, but you never really know.
They brew them heavy in Vermont.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely.
Well, hey, this was a ton of fun.
I was going to ask, Vivek, do you have anything you want to plug?
Yes.
I have nothing I want to plug. Besides my shop at dickssportinggoods.com if you're looking for your Nets jersey purchase. I might have some incentives there. What I will say is just we didn't quite touch on it, but if the Knicks hang out of the 4 seed, they win their first round. The Nets hang out of the 1 seed, they take care of business. That second round matchup, you know, the Knicks would have won a series against a good team. Obviously, the Nets will do what they do. That would be just fireworks. That would be electric. You know, I don't think a first round matchup's in the cards just the way the seedings are right now. But if they were to somehow meet as the 1-4, man, we're gonna have to.
That would be awesome.
That's exactly what we need. If we want there to be a rivalry, that is exactly what we need. We need some bad blood in the playoffs. We need one or two fights. Blake Griffin going at it with, I don't know who's the instigator on the Knicks. RJ Barrett? Would it be Blake and RJ? Taj?
Should be Taj.
Probably Taj. Yeah.
Blake and Taj.
Just to do it. Yeah, it'll be Taj.
Yeah, they both have nothing left to lose at this point in their careers. They're just going to hang on for a ring. I love that. That's perfect.
Oh, man.
Yeah, I made a conscious decision to become a Nets fan. Actually, when we were in New Hampshire at Jeff's place, the year that they signed Joe Johnson, because I was like, Joe Johnson, let's do it. Because I was thinking about being a Knicks fan, because I think that Carmelo season was like the year before, and I was like, I want to root for one team that lives in the place that I live, besides UConn. And so I had made that decision, and obviously because of Brad and my buddy Brendan, lifelong Nets fans, and I went with Brendan to so it was originally supposed to be the first game at Barclays was Knicks-Nets, and then that got rescheduled because of Hurricane Sandy, but we went to that game, and that was bananas. Like, I will 100% advocate till my dying day that a very engaged neutral crowd is actually, like, a split crowd is better than a one-sided crowd. It was just back and forth, guys going at it, like, in the, you know, in the stalls, like, in the hallways and everything like that. Like, it was really, really, really cool. So I can't imagine what that would be like for a playoff series. It would be a ton of fun.
It'd be awesome. It would get the primetime slot, you know, over, you know, any of these other potential second round matchups for sure. It would be just unbelievable. Absolutely unbelievable.
I'd fly back for it. I'm ready.
Yeah, for sure. I got my second shot today. Ready to go. Ready to hit up some playoff basketball.
Oh, wow. We're all fully vaxxed and waxed, awesome. Huh?
Yeah.
It's great. Ready to go.
Vaxxed and saxed, I
think.
All right, man. We should probably wrap this up. Brett,
yeah, I think so. Before we get vaxxed and Jarrett jaxed. Oh my God. Well, as always, if you're still listening at the 108 mark, we greatly appreciate it. This is a lot of fun to record. Hope you guys had a lot of fun listening to it. Shout out to Jeff Bellis, AKA Beth Jealous, AKA the Thunder Down Under. And listen, email us russellandfro@gmail.com. Oh, Carl, do you have one more quip? Please throw it out there.
I was going to say one love to Seth and Kevin as well.
As always. Email us, look us up on Twitter. You found us, as Carl mentioned, we are named after players that no longer exist on this version of the Brooklyn Nets. We're still holding out strong. Nets Nerd Podcast for nerds, by nerds, Stitcher, Breaker, Google, Apple, Spotify. That's all I got for you. Like a mama, you birthed me. Brooklyn, you nursed me. Nice. Me with hard knocks, better than Berkeley. They said you murked me by the time I was 21. That shit disturbed me, but you never hurt me. Hello, Brooklyn. If we had a daughter, guess what I'ma call her? Brooklyn Carter. When I left you for Virginia, it didn't offend you, cause you know I only stepped out to get dinner. Hello, Brooklyn. How you doing? Crazy, whatever.
Bad Dads are back.